Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 45, Overview of Roman History. If you think back to grade 5, there you were teaching 8 to 10,000 years of history as you went through the cultures from ancient India to Greece. In grade 6, you're starting at the very earliest with the Trojan War, approximately 1200 BC or BCE, and you're ending with the decline and fall of Rome, which might be 400, as late perhaps as 600 AD or CE, depending on how PC you want to be, how you're going to describe those dates. In any case, you're talking about 25% or even 20% of the amount of time that was covered in ancient history in grade 5. Should be easier, right? Should be even easier, much easier, when you get to the Renaissance or modern history, where you start to reduce things to 400 years, 200 years or so. However, here you have the difference between what went on in grade 5 and what goes on in grade 6, 7, and 8. In grade 5, as many parents have reminded me, you should not be speaking about ancient history, at least not until you get to the very end of the block in ancient Greece. You're speaking about ancient culture. You're speaking about ancient mythology. You are still, for the most part, telling wonderful stories about the gods of these various lands. And only in Egypt, Chaldea, Babylonia, do you start to get into really historically verifiable details about how people lived. In Greece, we can start to work with historically verifiable, documented lives, though individuals like Socrates and the pre-Socratic philosophers still have a quality of myth about them. But once we get past the seven kings, we are dealing in Rome with historically documented, verifiable individuals, or at least close enough to the genuine article. We have more factual material at our disposal. We have books written by individuals who sometimes were contemporaries, or at least came not so long after the actual fact, that they can give us a treasure trove of details. And we have more figures rising up as individuals, or something close to individuals, who in one way or another come in conflict with each other, are able to motivate others, are able to move history in one way or another. So the closer we come to our own time, the more we are working with historical fact, the more of a wealth of information we have, which we have to sort through and deal with. And of course, it's good to work with others who have done this. Some find Dorothy Harris stories about eminent Romans to be very helpful, or the very good books on history written by Kovacs. Here, the books that I alluded to in grade 5, the Durant books, are very, very good as source books, as an overview of the big story. And as ever, I give you the advice that Roberto Trusley also gives people when working with almost any subject. Go first to the children's library in your local library, if you've got one. A lot of them are being closed as I speak. Or go online to things that are at the level of, you know, directed to the level of children or young adults, because there you'll see people who really know how to reduce things to their essentials, how to find the most vivid and most interesting aspects of a historical period. You can't go wrong using them as role models, even if you may take a much less materialistic or much less cynical view of these things than they would do today. And also the wonderful book, When the World Was Rome, which also gives, in a biographical way, good insights into this time and those people. But do remember that a lot of your work is going to be throughout sixth grade, but most powerfully in history, eliminating the non-essential, really working with Steiner's basic exercise for anyone on a spiritual path or a pedagogical path or both. You know, decide what is most important for your class. As the sixth graders rise up before you with their uncertainties and the turmoil in their lives, but also with the sense of promise and a feeling of excitement about what's coming their way, let them be your guides as to which lives, which events, which historical movements are most important. And it should not be the same as the teacher who came before you last year or the year before. And it shouldn't be the same as what I found was good, what that you'll see in the slideshow that I present about Roman history. You have to see for yourself what is really most important and most essential. So what I'm going to give you now is an overview, a kind of movement from one aspect of Roman life to another that bears out these aspects of polarity and astrality that I spoke about, but which is neither exhaustive — there are other things that you can bring about Roman history — nor is it meant to be all-inclusive. You know, do it this way or no way. My way or the Appian way, as we would say. So this is all down as suggestion, and I'll show you in subsequent lectures how I would start to flush this out. To bring something of the relationship of Greek and Roman myth and culture, to start them out where they feel familiar and gradually segue to Roman life. And here we have that great epic, the Aeneid, written not in the time of Aeneas by any means, but written very consciously, written down, not recited, as was Homer's Odyssey, but written by the great Roman poet Virgil. Some have the impression that Virgil did this as a way of justifying the rulership of Augustus, showing that the emperors were the logical conclusion of Roman life. Others saying that Virgil was actually a prophet of sorts and was laying down a foundation for the coming of the Christ as the natural conclusion and apotheosis of Roman life. But in either case, it's good to share some aspects of this with the students. If you can only do it in one main lesson, that's fine. If you have the time, perhaps, to read excerpts from a good translation for children of the Aeneid, maybe 15 minutes a day at lunchtime for 2 or 3 weeks before you begin the actual Roman block. It's basically the Odyssey. Aeneas leaving Troy as Odysseus left it. Both encounter the same powerful figures and natural challenges. They both have to descend into the world of the dead, though we'd say that Aeneas's descent has a quality of perhaps less pessimism, less darkness about it. But the conclusion is different. Odysseus returns to his kingdom in Ithaca, whereas Aeneas must find an entirely new culture. He must be the founder of a new culture. And in the course of telling this tale, can also compare the names given by the Greeks and the Romans to gods who bear very much the same qualities. And this is good to point out to the students that the Romans, though they founded a very great, powerful, and in many respects long-enduring civilization, they were very imitative in nature. We'll see this again and again. They always felt a sense of inferiority about their own philosophy, their own poetry, their own drama, whenever they compared it to Greek models. And any well-funded Roman family would probably have a Greek slave or two in its midst, or might have hired a Greek philosopher, a Greek orator, a Greek rhetorician to come and train the children in the family and the adults as well. In fact, even the great Julius Caesar went off to the Greek Isle of Rhodes because of a speech impediment that he had and came back as a very forceful orator. So they should see that Greek life didn't just disappear, but was certainly on a material level overshadowed by Roman life and Roman culture, but that Rome was always aware of its antecedents and the foundation that it had among the Greeks. So some of the themes that you want to take up: the Aeneid as a preface to life in Rome, Greek and Roman gods, and then we go on to the legendary part of Roman history, the threefold structure of Roman history, beginning with the kings, moving to the republic, and then the empire. The Roman city as the model of what Rome was. And out of this comes civitas, civility, citizen, citizenship, these very important concepts even in our time, which the Romans really developed single-handedly. The polarity of families and citizens, religion and law, monarchy, as we'll see with the seven kings, and the life of the republic, which is perhaps the most quintessential part of Roman life, this central sort of heart of Roman history. We'll definitely want to look at Roman architecture, engineering, inventions, the incredible achievements, many of them buried and not coming back again into modern life until quite recently. The standardization of life, that is such a quality of Rome. How Rome created the same city again and again, the same form of the roads, the same form of government, repeatedly wherever it went. We'll want to talk about the failure, the final failure of the Republic, in woven together with the life of Julius Caesar, the emperor, and the empire over which he would rule, the decline and fall of Rome, the emperor and the pope, the Christianization of Rome, the Romanizing of Christianity. And with this, of course, as I said in my previous lecture on this subject, I think it is essential that one brings in the life of Jesus. Not in a religious converting way, of course, that should go without saying, but what do we know about Jesus as a historical figure? And I think that that would be acceptable both in an independent school and in a charter school as well, that it need not be construed as anything religious. And I have included lectures that I gave to my class, or main lessons, I guess they weren't, on a lecture level, talking about Jesus. So you can hear what that's like to go through the living hell of trying to do that to a modern class. So these are the basic themes, and I would say that you should give yourself at least 2 main lesson blocks, maybe even 3, to try to work with all of this, depending on how good you are at economizing and just finding the real central nerve of the historical work. And as you can see from the breadth and the variety of what's here, and we could go into Roman fashion and Roman food and Roman plumbing, I'll be alluding to many of these things in subsequent lectures to you, but you've got to see what is most important. Hopefully this won't be the last time you teach Rome. You know, don't always feel, I'll never do this again, let me squeeze all this in. You may find with your next class, even when you look at your notes, or maybe come back and take this conference again, you may want to do things very differently. So Rome gives you the possibility of real freedom in working with the curriculum. It can be a little bit scary, but don't feel that you simply have to go where others have gone before you. See if there are more creative ways of doing it. And in the light of this, this is also why I say to think of doing projects and to think of having the students present their projects. Maybe it's going to be really, really great, but I could only say it's going to be at the expense of perhaps very important content that you have worked out and through for them. You may find you just can't do it because they need time to show everybody how a catapult works. So please take that into consideration, that the problem with these project-oriented things going on today are that they do take away from other very important aspects of your work. So we'll go on now and start to go through the various stages of Roman history and ways of presenting them.